So people cannot live continuously in a state of horror, and a life instinct reasserts itself even in the midst of death. Nevertheless, the popular art and the popular literature had much to do with the theme of death. Well now, Holbein turns from that portrait of the dead Christ, goes to England, to Windsor Castle, and does those marvelous portraits of very living beings in the, among the English aristocracy. Henry VIII, the little boy, Henry VI, and the Protector Somerset, Anne Boleyn, and various others, certainly breathing vitality. And he does a number of other portraits of a similar quality. Bonifacius Amerbach is a marvelous picture of a man with a delicate, refined face, a luminosity about the eyes. Portraiture takes on a liver quality. It cannot be said that the Renaissance or the Reformation created portraiture, because very frequently in the Middle Ages, a religious picture would have a portrayal of the doors down in the corner, and often with very good portraiture. But certainly in this early 16th century, one does have a great vogue of portraiture with exact delineation and intense vitality. Now, what is the reason for this shift? Is it due to the Reformation, with its turning from death to resurrection, making less of the cross than of the risen Christ? Or is it the more secular interest of the Renaissance, which ceases to be so concerned about the life to come and directs its attention to the life here? There's a curious parallel in the field of literature here, namely, that the books on the art of dying tend to be supplanted by collections of proverbs. Erasmus made a collection of some 5,000 proverbs. Polydor Virgil made another. Sebastian Frank, a group of Nettesheim. Collections of proverbs, worldly wisdom. You can take a horse to water, you can't make him drink. Many hands make light work. One foot in the grave, and so on and so on. The proverb was the quintessence of universal worldly wisdom. And this it is which becomes more popular than the tracts on the art of dying. So whether this you call it Renaissance, whether you call it Reformation, at any place, at any rate, a change that does take place. And Holbein illustrates the transition. And now with regard to his specific connections with the Reformation, they are with Erasmus rather than with Luther. He did, as a matter of fact, one woodcut of Luther is the German Hercules. He has a lion skin over his shoulder, he has the great big club, and he's slaughtering all the scholastics. Well, now there's a debate as to whether this is a Reformation cartoon in favor of Luther, or whether it's a satire against Luther. Because Holbein was very close to Erasmus, who deprecated Luther's violence. And is this a shot at Luther because he had his big club and he's smashing them all? Or is he being heralded as the great German hero? There's a certain ambiguity about many of these illustrations. And Holbein did have his connection with Erasmus, and Erasmus has his connections with the Reformation specifically. Now, Holbein illustrated Erasmus' Praise of Folly. He didn't intend this to be permanent work. He simply put little sketches in the margins of a copy. But they were done with such frequency that forever after they have been used to illustrate the Praise of Folly and to illustrate the mood of the period. There is one, perhaps, of which exemplifies this more than others. It is the picture of the fool looking at himself in a mirror. A certain physical attitude, a certain self-appraisal. He's not the mere sot, but he's the fool who recognizes that he is a fool and has the capacity even to laugh at himself. There's a certain subtlety above these illustrations in the way of folly. And then he did three portraits of Erasmus. One is in Langford Castle, one is in the Louvre, and the other at the University of Basel. He catches only one Erasmus. It is the Erasmus of the Praise of Folly, with a sort of Mona Lisa smile around the corners of his mouth. It's interesting to see how different artists will handle the same man. When Dürer did Erasmus, he paints him as the scholar sitting at his desk with a certain air of abstraction over his work. When Quentin Metsys in the Netherlands does Erasmus, he got him at a younger age, he shows a young man with a pensive expression, his books about him, yes, but somewhat abstracted even from his books, with a touch of the contemplative. But for Holbein, it is the little smile playing around the corners of the mouth which strike you most. Now, there is one treatment of Erasmus which brings about a certain curious combination of a medieval theme and perhaps a Renaissance attitude. This is a woodcut title page for one of the tracts of Erasmus. And it shows Erasmus himself with his hand on top of the head of the god, Termius. Now, the use of that symbol of the god Terminus goes back to an episode in the life of Erasmus. At one time while he was in Italy, he was a tutor to the Archbishop of St. Andrews, a Scottish lad, an illegitimate son of the king, only 18 years of age. The boy was traveling with Erasmus in Italy and being instructed by him. When they parted, Alexander gave to Erasmus a little Roman gem, which had on in it the figure of the god Terminus. Now Terminus is the god of terminals, of bounds, of limits, and the ultimate bound is death. Erasmus placed under it the motto, Concedo nulli, I yield to no one. He was accused of arrogance in saying he would yield to no one. He said, these words are not mine. These are the words of Terminus, death. Therefore, I must press all my life long to achieve my tasks before I am summoned by Terminus. Now, it's interesting to compare this portrayal of Erasmus standing there with his hand upon the head of this pagan god, who is the symbol of the end, and an illustration in the Anatomy of Vesalius, which is about contemporary, which shows a skeleton with his hand upon a skull, looking like Hamlet, discoursing upon the skull of poor Iorio. It's a very animated skeleton. It's thoroughly medieval in its concentration upon death, and it uses the skull. This other one uses not the skull, but the pagan god. But the thought is very similar. You're back again to the contemplation of death, although you're no longer painting the dead Christ or putting out illustrations of the dance of death. I should have introduced earlier a little reference to that dance of death. I'll add it here now. It was a very popular theme to portray all aspects of life with a skeleton in the background or intervening to carry someone off. And Holbein did one of these. He shows the preacher in the pulpit with the hourglass in front of him, and behind him is the skeleton. He shows a wedding where the skeleton comes in and takes the bride by the hand and carries her away. He shows the priest going to give the last rites to someone dying, And walking ahead of him is the skeleton, which will take him away. And here is a mother giving broth to her 3 or 4 year old baby, and at the door appears the skeleton and takes the fearless little child by the hand to lead it out of the door. I should have brought this in earlier, because that is the illustration of the prevalent medieval theme, and as I said, that dies out. And yet, one does not lose consciousness of death. Death and life lie side by side. Emphases vary. One may give up the symbol of the skull and have in its place the symbol of the god Terminus. Holbein, then, is a certain transitional character. He has, if not one foot on earth and the other in the grave, one foot in the Middle Ages and then the other in the Renaissance and the Reformation, and the themes cut across each other. If one turns to Dürer, the situation is somewhat different. Partly because Dürer was a much deeper religious spirit from the very outset. In his earlier life, before he had come in contact with Luther at all, he did a portrait of himself as the man of sorrows. He had suffered from malaria, and one sees the effects of it in his face. But the features are the traditional features of Christ, and yet they are the features of Dürer. He has the long hair coming down, which is rather common in pictures of Christ. And near his rather emaciated, folded hands, you will see the crown of thorns, or the scourge of Christ, the symbols of the Passion. This itself is symbolic of the attitude of a generation. Men lived in a perpetual passion play. They were capable of identifying themselves with the biblical characters. One finds that coming up prominently also in the Reformation. It's in the Catholic period that Dürer so portrays himself. But the theme carries through, and later on we will find the Protestant artist Lucas Cranach portraying himself as Simon of Cyrene, carrying the cross of Christ. Or again, he will paint John Frederick, the Elector of Saxony, standing under the pulpit hearing Luther preach, and with a great cross over his shoulders. In the literary form, we have a most amazing parody, you might almost call it, of the trial of Jesus, according to John's Gospel, in which all the figures are contemporaries. Luther is Christ. Charles I is Pilate. The Archbishop of Mainz is Caiaphas. And so on, right down the line. They didn't feel it was blasphemy. They felt it was identification in a passion play in which they were all taking their part. Now, Dürer has that even prior to the Protestant period. And then he has a capacity for perceiving spirituality in what you might call ugliness. He has a portrait of his mother, a peasant face, rather distorted, with a deep pathos in her eyes. You don't find anything as penetrating as that in a Holbein. And Dürer did the Passion and the Nativity with a very rare feeling and delicacy. He did one also, The Prodigal Son. I like it better in his rough sketch than in his finished work, but that may be because we moderns are rather fond of the rough. We don't like things to be too finished up. In the completed work, he has the prodigal with the swine, and every hair on the swine is carefully done. And then there are barns in the background with vines trailing over them, and every leaf and twig on the vines most carefully delineated. The result, I find, is a certain distraction from the central theme. But in the original sketch, the preliminary sketch, the background is all rough. the prodigal has more of genuine agonized contrition on his face, I think, than in the finished work. At least it shows up more. And there's a greater focus upon the young man and a couple of the swine above him than there is in the completed work. But in any case, there is a very great depth of feeling. At the same time, Dürer to a degree, and for a period, rather obscured this element in his artistry, because he was carried away with the obsession of technique. And he traveled in Italy and became very much preoccupied with the techniques of perspective, even in intricate situations, as for example, where in the wall you have a round recess and you can see right down the hole. Well, how do you get perspective inside a circle like that? He has, in his Catholic period, a delineation of the Lord's Supper, in which it seems to me that the concern with the technique predominates. Over the head of Christ, there is a hole like this. And then when you come to the actual delineation of the scene itself, one feels that he has exerted himself in particular to do with exquisite accuracy every fold in the tablecloth on the table about which Christ and the disciples are sitting, and all of the folds in their robes, they link over each other and in and out, and then all of the curls in their hair. Theologically speaking, it shows his Catholic period, because Christ is seated in the center. Around his head there is a very large halo. He's looking up in abstraction and exaltation, and he does not seem to be a part of all of the group. Dürer in his later life came under the impact of Luther. He said that Luther had saved him from great anguish of spirit. And under the impact of Lutheranism, he does another Lord's Supper. It's very simple. There is no inaccuracy, of course, in the folds of the robe or of the tablecloth, but there is no over-display of technique. And on the side of the theology, in front of Christ, one has not the lamb, as in the Catholic one, I didn't mention that, but the cup, which of course was given to the laity. But the other feature is that Christ is in intimate conversation with the disciples. One hand is reached out to one or the other. So there's both a theological change here from the abstracted, exalted Christ to Christ the participant, and from the emphasis on the lamb to the emphasis on the cup. There are a few other points about Dürer which might be mentioned. One of them is rather trivial, but it rather intrigued me. He did a rabbit. You'll often see reproductions of that rabbit in people's studies and rooms. And an art historian has pointed out that that rabbit has, in his eye, the image of a window, and has therefore inferred that Dürer could not possibly have painted this out of woods, and he must have had that animal in his studio. Well now, there is, later on, by Cranach, a woodcut of Luther preaching, with popes, monks, and cardinals going down hell's mouth. And hell is a great big beast, which never was on sea or land, and in the eye of that beast there is the image of a window. Now, I would suggest that this is simply an artistic device for giving a certain piquancy to the picture, and that it does not necessarily require that the animal, or whatsoever it was in the artist's studio. But that's a minor detail. And there is another work of Dürer, however, to which I should refer, and I'm not proceeding in as orderly a manner as I might, and that is his great probably The Melancholia, in which a woman of high intelligence sits brooding with all the instruments of man's skill lying unused about her, and in the sky above there is a comet. This is the symbol of astrological determinism, of the stars controlling the fate of men. This belongs to his Catholic period, and incidentally, astrology had a great vogue among Catholics of that period. The popes had their own astrologers. Here is man caught between his own creative energy. In the Renaissance, they called it virtù, and fortuna, fortune, or fate. And this woman of high capacity sits inert until the issue of the star shall be determined. And yet beside her plays a little cherub, a child, insouciant of all of what perhaps may be the impending disaster, playing without concern. Is the meaning of it that simplicity, after all, rises over the very power of the fates and of the stars? At any rate, it indicates that the Renaissance, with all of its exuberance, had also a strain of melancholy. One never gets these sharp delineations in history. In Holbein, you have the medieval and the modern. You give up the dance of death, and you have the god Terminus. And in Dürer, likewise, one has a certain exuberance in his Renaissance period with all of his perspective experimentation, and then again, melancholia and high intelligence brooding in inactivity. Well, now when we come to the Cronox, the younger and the older, we are dealing with people much less gifted than Holbein or Dürer. It's rather sad that Dürer lived only a year or two after Luther. One wonders what he might have done for Protestant art had he lived longer. As a matter of fact, Protestant art tends to deteriorate and is displaced by music. It is from Bach and the period on down, under the impact of a Lutheran inspiration, that the artistic impulse finds its outlet rather than in the graphic arts. After Cronach, there is a decline. In Rembrandt, there is a revival. If he can be considered Protestant, he is believed to have been influenced by the Mennonites. And in his work, there is an intense preoccupation with the inwardness of religion. What amazing portrayals he gives of the father of the prodigal son, for example, of the crucifixion and so on. Here is a very intimacy of piety. But in general, there is rather a decline. And that may in part be due to the fact that art passes from expertness to understandability. What I mean is that instead of these magnificent altarpieces or superb portraits, one has the cartoon and the little woodcut that will go on a pamphlet. The Reformation took advantage of the printing press for wide dissemination. Thousands of these little pamphlets would be distributed, and they were illustrated, rather crudely illustrated, cheaply illustrated. This means that art is serving the populace but it also means that it loses some of its expert. Well, now in the Cronox, again, we have something transitional, because they do both works of a high quality and on a large scale, and also the cartoon kind of thing. The Cronox were distinguished for portraiture, and most of our portraits of Luther, Cady, Melanchthon, Jonas, Kreuziger, in the Lutheran circle, and then in, among the rulers of the period, Joachim I, the Elector of Brandenburg, his son Joachim II, Eric of Braunschweig, Christian of Denmark, and so on. We have a whole series of these portraits of the leading figures in religion and in politics in this period. And these are all done on the grand style, grand not only with regard to the face, but also the costumes. I think he had a good time over that. He always gives them all their jewels and their necklaces, and makes their robes very resplendent, and devotes almost as much attention to their fur coats as to their hair. But their hair, too, gave him fine opportunities, for they anticipated the long hair of our generation. Well, the Cronox were great portraitists. Also, the Cronox went in for themes for the sheer interest in artistic delineation, I would suppose. As, for example, in Botticelli's Venus, it doesn't serve any polemic or didactic purpose. And Cronach did a number of female nudes of great grace and delicacy. Luther wasn't particularly fond of them. And I doubt whether he was particularly fond of a portrayal of himself by Cronach as a naked Apollo. The young, brilliant god who was bringing light to his generation. I don't know whether Luther ever saw it. Maybe it was discovered afterwards. But Cronach is responsible for the woodcuts of Luther, the early ones where the cheekbones protrude, the later ones when he had become, to put it mildly, somewhat portly. One of Melanchthon in his old age, where he looks pretty wizened, very lovely, a double miniature of Luther and Canon Verbora, that's preserved at Wolfenbüttel. And then a choice one of Luther's daughter. So the whole Wittenberg circle is made vivid for us by Cronach. And then he has one of Frederick the Wise holding his scepter like this. When I showed it to my students, they always said, "Freddy at the bat." Portraiture then, we have. To some extent, the delineation of Christian themes, a crucifixion, for example, in which the reformers are all gathered about the cross. And there's another one in which the blood from the wound of Christ comes in a stream and is caught in a chalice, which is held by Lucas Cronach himself. And then, as I said, there's another in which he is Simon of Cyrene, carrying the cross. Again, the identification of the artists and his subjects with the biblical characters. Well, now, in addition to this painting in the high manner, we have what I referred to as almost caricature. Well, sometimes it is. And there was, for example, a book which was called The Passional Christi and Antichristi, The Passional of Christ and of Antichrist. The theme went back to John Huss and Wycliffe, who contended that the popes were Antichrist, and drew contrast between the simple Christ riding on a donkey and the pope riding on a stallion, and so on. There was a copy of one of these books illustrated and written in the Czech language in the library of Frederick the Wise. Now, Melanchthon and Cronach got together on this, And Melanchthon wrote little verses, and Cronach did the illustrations of the contrast between Christ and Antichrist. You have Christ washing the disciples' feet. You have the Pope sitting in his chair, holding out his toe to be kissed. You have Christ refusing to be a king, and the Pope in armor, with his troops around him, besieging the cardinals who are making an election, so that they've got to elect him. You have the Pope raking in the money from the indulgences, and Christ so poor that he has to catch a fish and open it to get enough money out of it to pay the tribute. Christ goes on barefoot, or at most on a donkey, and the Pope on a great stallion. And incidentally, all the way through, the Pope has the features of Leo X, except once. The Pope in armor is Julius II with his big beard. And in the end, of course, Christ ascends to heaven, and Antichrist goes down to hell. And there we are. This is obviously polemical cartooning. Now, there came to be a good deal of this. Broadsides were issued. In German, they call them Holschnitt. Holschnitt, something or other. Anyway, big size woodcuts. They were. We have a whole set of them reproduced, and I should say they're about, they may be 3 feet by 2.5 or something like that. And apparently they were put up as placards, and they're rather raw in their polemic. They have a grand time with all the devils, of course, and they always run in to carry off the Pope and his minions to the appropriate place. And the popes and the cardinals and all the rest are portrayed in rather unpalatable guise. They are the foxes in the vineyard. They are the wolves. They're all the wild beasts of the forest, and so on. The Catholics countered with some cartooning, but not as much. It's a revolutionary movement which is more likely to engage in vulgar attack than an established institution which feels that it can preserve its dignity and refrain from replying in kind. But that's not altogether true. Both in caricature, Luther was pilloried, and in popular rhyming verse and so on, the vulgar slapdash characterized both sides, but the volume of it is probably greater with the Protestants. And the volume of tracts was very great. More tracts were issued in Germany in 4 years, between 1522 and 1526, than in any other period of German history. Of course, later on, they had a newspaper, and they had a periodical. But when we're talking about just about tracts, these little pamphlets, there are more of them in those 4 years than at any other time. And most of them have to do with the religious issues. Another opportunity for the artistic was illustrations of the Bible. Now, these are both serious and polemical. In Luther's September Bible of 1522, the New Testament, the scarlet woman in the book of Revelation wears the papal tiara with three crowns. And the great beast that comes up out of the abyss looks something like a bull, but he's got a big flap of skin that comes just back of his neck that looks like a monk's cowl. And the dragon out of the abyss is wearing the papal tiara. And Babylon is most obviously Rome. You can see the Belvedere and other well-known buildings in Rome. And these are all in the illustrations to the Book of Revelation. Well, Duke George of Ducal Saxony was a good Catholic, and the cousin of Frederick the Wise, Luther's prince, protested. And Frederick said, this is just a bit too much. You've got to change those pictures. Well, what they did in the next edition was to cut the tiara down to one layer. You see, with a woodcut, you can do that. You can't add to it, but you can use a chisel and cut out some of it. So in the December edition, you've just got a blank where the top two layers were and just the one layer crown. But they didn't take this, well, they did that on the dragon's crown too, but they didn't do anything about that beast with the monk's cowl. And rather a funny thing happened. The Catholic Emser put out a Catholic New Testament in order to supplant Luther's, and he took over the illustrations. And he took over that cowl on that big beast that looks like a monk and didn't notice what he got apparently. So he put that into the Catholic Bible. After Frederick the Wise was dead, they did these woodcuts all over again, put the three-layer crown back on. So it was quite a while before they were willing to give up that sort of thing. But apart from polemics, they did very fine work on biblical illustration. Curiously, however, only for the Old Testament, the book of Revelation. And this is not due to the Reformation, because there were 17 pre-Lutheran German translations of the Bible. They're rather crude. Luther's translation is vastly superior, but they existed and they were illustrated. And it's only for the Old Testament and Revelation. And for the Gospels and for Paul, they just have initial letters. Now why? I don't know. But a professor, Boucher, at Brown University, I'm told, has discovered manuscripts of the 13th and 14th centuries in Paris where the Gospels are illustrated all the way through. He hasn't published them yet. Yale Press is bringing it up. Well, it's rather curious that the Gospels should have been illustrated all the way through, and then they should have been dropped, and only the Old Testament Revelation. And then after Luther, one of his disciples, Dietrich, put out an epitome of the Luther Bible with illustrations of the Gospels and the life of Christ all the way through. Well, I have no explanation for this. But incidentally, I did put out a book entitled The Martin Luther Gospel Book, in which I used all of those Gospel illustrations from the 1562 edition of his work. I might throw in a word about the artist who did those. His name was Virgil Solis. He's rather a minor artist. But he did such an enormous amount of work that modern biographers have been tempted to advance the date of his death in order to give him time to get it all done. His illustrations are rather quaint and piquant, and from a technical point of view, interesting, though perhaps not more so than that of others, but anyway, he has one of the Journey to Emmaus, and he has Christ and the disciples in the foreground, and then he does what the artists often did. They put two scenes into one picture, and way up in the corner, he has the picture of the house where they were sitting at a table when they recognized Christ. Now, the background of that is cross-hatching. Now, cross-hatching is lines that go at right angles to each other and fill up the space. You know, all of this had to be cut in a block. The woodcut was made with a block of hard wood cut across the grain and then chiseled out. Well, you make that cross-hatching then by cutting out tiny little squares. They're so small, and remember, they didn't have any way of magnifying, so this has got to be the original size. They are so small that it almost takes a magnifying glass to distinguish them. So the technique with these tiny little chisels and that hard wood involved an incredible accuracy. But I'm getting away from subject matter now to technique. For some curious reason, you have only the Old Testament and Revelation. But the Old Testament illustrations are very fascinating, not only for the Bible, but for the period. Because, of course, they dress everybody as they dressed. They gave a picture of Jerusalem. It might just as well be Nuremberg or Augsburg or Wittenberg. They have the rebuilding of the temple, and it's a good picture of architectural engineering in the 16th century with all of their derricks and their inclined planes and their mortar and all the rest of it. They dress all of their soldiers like German Lanzknechten, and their armor and their spears and all the rest of it are contemporary. So that from our point of view, we get not only a visualization of biblical scenes, but very fascinating pictures of contemporary Germany. This is particularly interesting when we come to the Nativity. Cronach did one of the Nativity. It is distinguished by its simplicity as over against Renaissance portrayals. In the Italian Renaissance portrayals in particular, one usually has classical ruins in the background. They had enough historical sense to realize that the Palestine of Jesus' day was not the Italy of their day, and they wanted something to indicate antiquity, but they just took classical Roman ruins and usually put them for decoration here and there. Naturally, they portrayed all of the characters in the biblical story from their own contemporaries. The Virgin became Madonna, a lovely Italian maid. The Christ child was the Bambino. The wise men were the nobles of the Apennines. And then all of this in the background had the classical ruins. Well, when Cronach does it, the Virgin is a rather plump German maid. You don't have any classical ruins. You have a simple German Kuhstall, a cow stall. The general impression is the one that Luther gave. He emphasized the squalor at the birth of Christ, the condescension of God, willing to lie in swaddling clothes and in the feed box of a donkey. It's not glory, and it's not away in a manger. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head. Away in a manger was not written by Luther, and it's altogether too sweet for him. It's not laying down the sweet head in the star looking down so joyfully. It's dirt, cold, darkness, misery, rejection. No one would give up a room in the inn. It is in the midst of squalor that the Son of God was born. Now you get that feeling from Cronach's representation with its rather crude portrayal of the stable and the ox and the ass and the holy couple. So there's a departure from the grand in painting because the theme itself has taken possession and has imposed an artistic simplicity. There's one other point I'll mention, and that is that so many editions of Luther's Bible were put out during his lifetime and illustrated independently, very frequently, so that in the end there came to be 500 illustrations of his Bible before his death. Now all of those have been reproduced in a magnificent volume by Schramm. Luther Deutsche Bibel. In those books you will find, in style, a transition from Renaissance to Baroque. The earlier ones, done by Cronach and his school, show a Renaissance parallelism and a certain degree of stability. You have Jacob wrestling with the angel, and they just sort of stand up there like two pillars. You turn to the later period, where Georg Limberger was the artist, and you have them in vehement attention, the one figure against the other, and the striking thing about it is that the very trees participate. They twist and they're caught in a wind, so that you feel that the entire picture is pulsating with vitality, and life and conflict and tension. So one discovers artistic styles changing in the representation of similar events. And sometimes it is the theme which dominates the portrayal, and sometimes it's the artistic manner of the time which dictates what the artist will see in the scene. Well, this then is a brief sketch of the graphic arts in the service of the church. There was not very much illustrating that was done anymore for churches. The Protestants, the Lutherans, took over the Catholic churches and retained their altar pieces. The Zwinglians would have no art abolished at all. The Calvinists would allow only a cross, but not a crucifix, not the body of Christ on the cross. So you get a whole anti-artistic strain with Zwingli, the Anabaptists, the Calvinists, and the English Puritans, the Quakers. There's a big shift taking place in our own day with a return to the artistic tradition and also to the liturgical tradition. But the Lutherans retained the Catholic art. As I say, they didn't continue to produce great art, but they kept it. The area of productivity was in music, in singing by the congregation, in the great chorales. This is the primary sphere, and I wish I were competent to dilate on that. But I happen to know a little bit more about the pictorial. Well, I don't know enough to answer many questions, but if you have any or wish to raise some discussion, then we might partake of it.
Sir, was Holbein a
convert
to Lutheranism?
No, he was not.
He remained Lutheran.
Yes, he did. And then, as I say, it's a question whether that cartoon of Luther the Hercules is meant to be for him or against him.
Yeah.
No, he did not. So, in a way, I should, you might say, I shouldn't have included him. But as I say, he's a sort of a transitional figure. He's on the frame.
There was a younger too in Holbein, right?
Yes, there are two. And I might as well make my good confession and admit that I'm not quite sure which works are one and which are the other in every instance. That's something I ought to work through and get exactly right.
The
same thing is two or two chronops. I know that most of the portraits of the German princesses are by the younger chronop, and those are lucratively circled by the elder.
The one you were talking about, the Christ view, which is so terrible, gruesome,
yes,
at Basel, is by the elder.
I think so. And the Fraser Folly ones are by the elder.
Is this the, I think that's the largest collection in the world at Basel of Holbein?
Yes, it is. That's right. But others are scattered in various places. I got the jacket for my book from the Earl of Radnor, who had a castle in Wales. Incidentally, I had quite a time to get back. I wrote him, and I said, could I use this? Why, certainly. He said, but you know, you can get it reproduced in color if you'll write to an engraver in Italy. I wrote to him, he said, oh yes, I can do it. It costs you $15. But he said, you know, you'll have to get permission from an English engraver to do my work. So I wrote to him, and he said, yes, $16. So I was up to $31. Well, after a while, the negative came in color. And I was carrying it from the university library up the hill to the divinity school on my bicycle in a drenching rain. And I came to a great puddle in the street and skirted it, but on the edge ran into mud, slipped, went down the puddle, on my chest, whack, smack. But the Lord gave his angels charge over me, ran on the back of my bicycle up in the air, and he came through fire.